And I'm afraid I don't have any theorems yet, so you will have to bear with me. I only have conjectures, but that's good, because maybe you guys can help us out. This is work done in collaboration with Nimar Kani-Hamed, Jared Kaplan, Cliff Cheon, Jake Bujarli, and Jaroslav Trinka. Very good. So I promised to tell you what's the connection between Grassmannians and particle colliders. So let me start with the physics. So right now, you probably all have heard that at CERN, there is a Large Hadron Collider. Okay, and what is that? Well, it's a big, big tunnel with a big accelerator inside. That is 27 kilometers in circumference. And what are they doing? Well, they are smashing protons together. How many protons are they smashing together? Well, each of these beams will have roughly 100 billion protons, each of them. But we're not interested in what happens to the 100 billions of them. We're interested in what happens when you have one proton and another proton that come and collide head-on with each other. Even that is not what is interesting for us at the moment, because we know that inside each proton we have quarks, and the quarks are held together by particles called gluons. And what's going to happen, which is going to be interesting for us, is when two of these protons come together, they smash against each other, and one gluon from each side collide with another, producing other gluons. And these gluons will disappear, producing particles that will measure at detectors, and these are called jets. Okay? But that is what we want to study. We want to study what happens when we have gluons coming together, smashing against each other, producing other gluons. Okay? The way physicists describe this is by using something that is called the scattering matrix. Okay? This is nothing but the following. You start describing your initial state as a state in a Hilbert space. Say these are particles, I'll label them to be particles 1 and 2. So I have particles 1 and 2. I evolve this state in time, allowing the state to interact. And then I measure the overlap of this state with some particular external state, which is another state in my Hilbert space. And these elements, these matrix elements, are what make up what is called the S matrix. And this is what we want to compute. And that's what our friends will measure in their detectors. Very good. But in order to tell you that, I have to tell you how physicists think about space-time. Well, or better yet, how you can think about space-time the way we talk about it. So space-time for us is nothing but an affine space, R4, with coordinates x mu and a quadratic form given by this. The choice of the quadratic form is what tells us that we're working with Minkowski space. The group that preserves the quadratic form is SO3,1 and is called the Lorentz group. Now, this is an affine space. Therefore, we have the action of the Poincaré group acting on it. The Poincaré group is the semi-direct product of an abelian group, which is a group of translations in space-time, which is isomorphic to R4, times the Lorentz group, which here I take to be SL2C, which is the covering of SO3,1. Now, given our space-time, I only have to tell you what particles are. So I've told you where the space in which these interactions are taking place, Now I have to tell you what physicists think particles are. Now, particles are described and classified as irreducible representations of the Poincaré group, and that problem was already solved by Wigner in 1939. Now, if you define the group of characters of A, which is an abelian group here, it's isomorphic to R4 with coordinates P mu, and this is a precise map, and P mu is what physicists will call momentum space, okay? So everything that I'm going to talk about will be described in terms of momentum space, and the relation to coordinate space is, as usual, physicists like to say, we just perform a Fourier transform. But that's just because this is the relation. Very good. So how do you go on and classify the irreducible representations of the Poincaré group? The trick is the following, is to look at the orbits of A hat under H. Now, in our case, we have these momentum vectors, P. If we take P squared and define P squared to have a constant, to be a constant, this is invariant under the Lorentz group, and therefore, any P that has the same square defines an orbit of the Lorentz group. Now, this number M is what physicists call the mass of the particle, and the stabilizer of a point, P, in this orbit, is called the little group. It's a subgroup of the Lorentz group. Now, the irreducible representations of the Poincaré group are classified by the IREPs, or the irreducible representations of the little group. For M positive, we talk about massive particles. Those are the particles we know and love, like the electron and the proton. The little group is SU2, and the representations are classified by a half integer called the spin of the particle. For massless particles, when M is equal to zero, the little group is a group of motions in R2, and the reducible representations are half integers called the helicity of the particle. Now I can tell you precisely what these objects are. The objects that we are scattering are called gluons, but whenever you hear the word gluons, you can think about massless particles of helicity plus or minus one using these definitions. You probably have heard about gravitons as well. So let me tell you what they are. They are massless particles of helicity plus minus two. Now, our scattering matrix is supposed to be something that transforms properly under the Poincaré group. What do I mean by that? Well, it's made out of one particle states, and therefore it has to transform under the product representation of each of the individual representations of the one particle states. So how do we construct objects with the correct properties? And here is a trick. The trick is to use building blocks. For each particle, we define... So for each particle, we define these vectors, lambda I in C2, and lambda I tilde in C2, so that they transform as negative and positive chirality spinors of the Lorentz group. Okay? And what do we do with them? Well, the claim is that that's all you need in order to describe all the physical data of the particles you are scattering. Well, you would say you were talking about the momentum of the particle, which was a vector. How do you relate this vector to this data? Well, the way you do it is the following. You use a standard map that you use for to understand the action of SL to C on points in space-time, okay? In order to construct that 2x2 matrix. And this 2x2 matrix, physicists like to denote the components as A dot, where A goes from 1 to 2 and A dot from 1 to 2. And this is now made for the particle I, is made from our spinors in the way described over there. Okay? That's the way we describe the data. Now, what are the properties of the scattering matrix that has to be impose on it so that it's a physical scattering matrix. Well, the properties is that if you have a function of these spinors, it can only depend on the spinors through these invariant combinations, the contractions using the invariant tensor epsilon AD. We denote that using these brackets. If we have the lambdas of negative chirality, if we have the lambdas of positive chirality, we use this bracket to denote the contraction. And the final condition, in order to have a nice S matrix or a nice function that transforms correctly under the Poincaré group, is that it must be homogeneous in this form under the rescaling of lambda I and lambda I tilde with opposite signs. It must come with a factor of minus 2 times the helicity of the particle. In our case, we have particles of helicities plus minus 1. Okay. But where is the Grassmannian in the whole story? Very good. So how can any of this be related to Grassmannian? And the hint comes from the following. Let's just label the physical scattering data. We have all these particles scattering. So we have, as I said, spinors for each particle. Let me put them in this matrix. We have, for every particle, we have one spinor here and one spinor here. This is a particle index. We have particles 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on up to n, and here as well. And just until 2 years ago, we had been thinking about this as a matrix made out of two vectors, okay, n two vectors. Now, the deep duality that I want to propose today is the following. I want to think about this not as a matrix of two n vectors, but as a matrix of, instead of a matrix of n two vectors, as a matrix of two m vectors. So I want to think about this as a full vector, and this as a full vector as well. So we now have four m vectors. Why do I think that that's useful? Well, the reason is the following. If we think about the Lorentz group, now I'm going to cheat a little bit because I have to define, what I want to do now is to define the Lorentz group using a quadratic form that has signature plus plus minus 1, where the Lorentz group in this signature is a SL2R cross SL2R. Okay? Now, if this is a Lorentz group, then each copy of SL2R, let me call this G left and G right, G left and G right will act on these matrices on the right. So we have these two M vectors, and we have an SL2R acting on them. Now, the spinors in this signature are all real. So this is hinting that perhaps the physical data should be described as points in G2NR, in the Grassmannian of two planes in RN. Okay? So in Rn, we have our plane made out of the lambda vectors, and we have, so I'll suppress one dimension for the other one, the lambda tilde plane. Okay? I'll give names to this plane. I'll call this one the gamma plane, and this one the sigma plane. Okay. Of course, in order to finish the description of the scattering met of the data, I have to tell you the helicities of the particles that are interacting. And the scattering matrix will be harder or simpler depending on the helicities of the particles. Okay. But this might just be a coincidence, that the physical data seems to be described in terms of points in a Grassmannian. Let's try to get more hints. by cheating a little bit and looking at the answer. Okay? Let's try to look at the answer for some scattering amplitudes and then see if we can see anything related to Grassmannian. So let's look at amplitudes computed by Park and Taylor in the 80s. So they consider the scattering of gluons where all of the gluons had positive helicity, plus one helicity, except two of them. So all of them had positive helicities and two of them had negative helicity. Well, they discover a remarkably simple formula for this. The formula is the following. Well, not quite. There are pieces that are missing. We know that in order to have invariance under translations in coordinate space, if this formula is a formula in the dual space, in the Fourier transform space, we need this scattering matrix to be a distribution that is supported only on momenta that satisfy momentum conservation. That's the physical term for this. Okay? Only when the sum of all the p's is equal to zero, you get something that in coordinate space is translational invariant. So this is a very important physical piece of the amplitude. Now, gluons come in different colors or different combinations of colors. In fact, what this means is that gluons, really, there are eight species of particles. Each of them is different. They interact among themselves. So in physics, we have eight different particles. And this happens to coincide with the dimension of the adjoint representation of SU3. Okay? Today, we're going to consider SUN in general. And the way you can tell what the interaction is by weighting this. If each gluon carries some color index AI, with I going from 1 to 8, okay, in the case of SU3, but in general, n squared minus 1 in the case of SUN, we weight this by the product of the traces in the fundamental representation of SUN, okay, corresponding to the particular gluons that we are scattering, and we take the trace of this. And here, we sum over permutations modulo cyclic transformations, okay, because the trace is cyclic, and this object is also, the denominator is also cyclic. This is the answer. Well, can you see a Grassmannian there? Almost, right? Because we have these brackets. These brackets are nothing but the Plucker coordinates of that object, of the Grassmannian. Right? These brackets here. Now we can see something else that is interesting that tells us that really we should be thinking about the Grassmannian. And it's the following. If you look at the momentum conservation condition written in terms of the spinors, the lambdas, the condition is the following. Momentum conservation implies that the sum over all the particles must be zero. For all the four possible combinations that we have. Well, what does that mean? It means that we have the lambda plane defined by these two vectors and the lambda tilde plane defined by lambda tilde, sorry, by the lambda tilde vectors. Now, momentum conservation, which is something in physics that is very important for us, is simply telling us that these vectors in Rn with the standard metric are orthogonal to each other. So, Any two planes such that one lives in the complement of the other one will define physical scattering data that satisfies its momentum conservation. So this is simply the statement that gamma and sigma, my two planes, must be orthogonal to each other with our metric in Rn. Now, life is not as simple, because you would immediately tell me that this is not enough to define a Grassmannian. You need invariance under GL2, not SL2, right? Because if you want to talk about a plane, if you only have SL2 invariance, it's not enough to just be talking about the plane, because you can have different vectors related by rescaling that define the same plane, but I'd be telling you that they define different physical configurations. But this didn't stop us. We said, well, this is too beautiful to just give it up, and let's try to take the Grassmannian picture seriously. And let's push it and try to write a formula that is actually defined on G2N for this scattering amplitude. So now I would like to define this object here. This piece multiplied by the momentum delta function as A that will depend on the number of particles and the number of negative helicity particles, which are called K. So I'll define K to be the number of negative helicity particles, and M minus K to be the number of positive helicity particles. You can already see that you probably recognize K and M minus K as appearing in the literature when you talk about Grassmannians. And you also know that if you think about a Grassmannian, it's natural to have an isomorphism between the Grassmannian of K planes in Rn and the Grassmannian of M minus K planes in Rn. Well, in physics, this is exchanging pluses and minuses, and thus an operation that is called parity. Okay, that's another hint that what we're doing is in the right track. So let's go back and take this seriously and try to write our amplitude, N2, with that particular ordering as an integral over a Grassmannian, over this Grassmannian. So I'll define the plane points in the Grassmannian by, I'll parameterize point in the Grassmannian by this, as usual, by a 2 by M matrix modulo GL2 transformations on the right, okay? So there is a natural 2 times N minus 2 form, holomorphic form, that you can define on the Grassmannian, okay? This measure is a generalization of the measure on CPN, where if you have coordinates on CPN, you can define the measure to be it's a projective measure, okay? Now, there is a natural measure on the Grassmannians, which is projectively invariant under GL2 cross GLN. Okay. Now, in order to define an integral over the Grassmannian, we have to make something that makes sense projectively, that eats up the weights under the GL2 transformation. Okay. So how can I do that? Well, under a GL transformation, under a GL1 transformation, this will pick up precisely 2 times N minus 2. It will pick up If I rescale every coordinate by t, this will pick up a factor of t to the 2n, okay? One way to eat up this weight is by putting in the denominator the Pluker coordinates that somehow will mimic this structure here. But on top of that, I would like to ask something that will impose momentum conservation. And the way I do that is by writing this delta function here. This delta function says that my C plane, my plane C here, must be orthogonal to this lambda tilde plane. So I'm integrating over planes that are orthogonal to this lambda tilde plane. But I also want to ask the following. I want to impose that my lambda plane is contained in the C plane. You would say, well, that's a stupid thing to do because you're integrating over two planes and the lambda plane was a two plane. Well, you will see that this will lead us away to generalize this description. But it's not as silly as it sounds, because now, even though my physical data depends on the rescalings, this is an integral over a Grassmannian. That's what I wanted to do. Okay? Of course, if you now look at the weight of this object here, it's not GL invariant, and we have to eat up the weight. And the way to do it is precisely by putting a minor here to the fourth power. Now, this is an integral well-defined on G to N. Okay? It's not really an integral because the delta function is completely localized. So I don't even have to tell you the contour, so I don't have to worry about that. Very good. So the claim is that you take this object, you use the delta functions to localize the integral, and the result is going to be precisely AN2, including the delta function. So as written, this is a distribution, and it's going to be a complicated object to deal with, as written with the distribution inside it, but we will find a way around it. Now, let me just tell you, in case you get interested in this, that physicists like to, instead of defining this measure for the Grassmannian, we don't usually like to think about this. And what we do is to integrate over the space of all entries in the matrix and do something that mathematicians will find a little bit funny, which is to divide by the volume of GL2. Okay? Well, but that's the way we like to think about this. It's as if we were doing a gauge theory, and the gauge theory was invariant under GL2. We will have something that is not well-defined in principle, but dividing by the volume of GL2 is only there to remind us that we have to gauge fix to some particular configuration and then work on. That, in the mathematical terms, is nothing but choosing a coordinate patch and then choosing a patch where you set some of the Plucker coordinates to one. You can set any two columns to be the identity, to produce the identity matrix, and that will give you a patch on the Grassmannian. Very good. Now we are ready to make the proposal, the general proposal. So we have succeeded in writing the Park-Taylor formula as an integral over a Grassmannian. Now, motivated also by this correspondence between the number of minus helicity particles and the number of plus helicity particles, we were led to consider general Grassmannians, GKN. Here I wrote CN, but that will come later. At the moment, we're only in the reals. So this would be a Grassmannian of K planes in Rn, okay? Of course, just to remind you that we usually use Plucker coordinates, and these are only invariants under SLNK, so these are good projective coordinates. And this is just to set up my notation. I'm denoting by 1, 2, through K, the minor made in red. I don't know if you can see here, but is the determinant of this minor, okay? And see that in physics, the physics problem is telling us that there is a natural cyclic structure that we have to keep. For a given color structure, it's telling us that there is an ordering for the particles. So the particles are ordered, and we will only be considering minors that are consecutive minors in the denominator. In the numerator, we will get more interesting minors, which will depend on which particles carry negative helicity. Okay, and here is a claim that the general amplitude is related to this Grassmannian. How is it related? Well, just as a straightforward generalization of the formula I wrote here, you consider this object we call LNK, and it's an integral over the Grassmannian with the measure that I mentioned before. Now you have a straightforward generalization. Instead of this small minor to the fourth, remember you now have k particles of negative helicity. So you take the k particles of negative helicity, you consider that minor, and you put it to the fourth in the numerator, and you multiply by all the consecutive minors in the denominator. You have n of them. This piece with the measure is now well-defined on the Grassmannian. And you have these two delta functions, which are the analog of these delta functions, and they are defined here. Their job in life is to simply say that you are now integrating so now, in Rn, we are integrating over the space of k-planes. The delta functions are telling us that we are only interested in k-planes that contain the two-plane that I call gamma, which was the one related to lambda, that I also call the lambda plane. And the other delta function is telling us, this delta function is telling us this, what I just said, and the other delta function is telling us that the k-planes I'm interested in must be orthogonal to the sigma plane, which is also two-plane, and that I called before the lambda tilde plane. Okay? So that's the claim. You just somehow, this integral, which I haven't defined completely for you, is supposed to know about these physical scattering amplitudes. Very good, very good. So as shown there, you have all the right to complain. And you should, indeed, because I haven't defined it for you. I haven't told you what the contour is of integration. So let me list the problems. Which I hope you are all thinking about. Okay? If I'm missing one, please let me know. But the problem is that I haven't told you what the contour is. Oops. How do you spell contour? What is a contour? Okay. Well, in fact, is there any contour in which this integral is well defined? Okay. Now, for the physicists, you should be thinking that, well, this is not very satisfying because you are doing everything with real in the wrong signature. For your space-time, you're looking at this signature, well, you should be looking at this signature. It's even worse because you're looking at spinors which are real, and you should be looking at the spinors, which are complex. So this formula doesn't make sense from the math point of view, and it doesn't make sense from the physics point of view. So it's a little bit discouraging. But the resolution to the puzzle, okay, That's the problem. Those are the problems. But let me, before telling you the resolution, let me tell you why you should be encouraged, okay? So good things about it. Okay? If you have k equals 0, okay, you're looking at the space of points in Rn that contain a two-plane. Of course, that's impossible, right? So our formula is giving 0 for an infinite number of scattering amplitudes, right? For any n, it's predicting that we should get 0. Now, for k equals 1, you also get that it's impossible, so you also get 0. Likewise, for k equals n, you get 0. And for k equals n minus 1, you get 0. But it turns out that this is right. These amplitudes actually vanish in physics. So we are getting an infinite number of correct answers out of a formula that doesn't quite make sense. But that's encouraging. So let me now tell you how to make sense out of this formula. The way to make sense is the following, is to say, well, if you look at this, we are not really integrating over the space of k-planes because you have this delta function sitting in there. You are integrating over the space of k-planes that contain a fixed two-plane and are orthogonal to another two-plane. That means that you should really be thinking about the space of k minus two-planes, right? And even if you are, if you want to push it further, if you want to get rid of some of these delta functions, you can think about the space of k minus two planes in Rn, okay, just the ones that are orthogonal to the gamma plane, okay? And if you want to really think about what this integral is doing, it really wants to be an integral only over the space of k minus two planes in n minus four dimensions. The reason is that this k plane has to be orthogonal, or the k minus two plane has to be orthogonal to this R4 made out of the gamma plane and the sigma plane. So if somehow we manage to go to the physically relevant space, this one or perhaps this one, perhaps we'll get something that is well-defined, something where we can answer these questions. Well, it turns out that it's possible. Of course, otherwise I wouldn't be here giving the talk. And the way to do it is to introduce new variables. You combine the four vectors, the four numbers that you have here describing the data of a given particle, you put them together into a single four vector where the first two entries are straightforwardly the first two entries here, and the last two entries are given by a linear combination, or a linear combination of these ones, provide the data to compute the second two vector. Now, this is very straightforward to motivate this by asking the following: how can I make a change of variables that will map k by k minors, right, the Plucker coordinates of my Grassmannian, my original Grassmannian, to k minus 2 by k minus 2 minors, okay? That was the main problem in going from here to here. Our formula depended on the Plucker coordinates of this space, and now we would like to write a formula that depends on the Plucker coordinates of this space. And it turns out that the answer comes very straightforwardly to be this change of variables. And it depends very strongly on the fact that the minors are consecutive to each other, that the minors are made out of columns that are consecutive to each other. That's how you see this cyclic structure, the cyclic structure appearing here. Very good. So once you perform this change of variables, the original integral that wasn't well defined factors into two pieces. This is an integral that I just defined here, okay? That I claim agrees with the Park-Taylor formula and produces the momentum-conserving delta function, which is a distributional part of the amplitude, and another piece, which is an integral over the space of k minus 2 planes in Rn. Okay. Now I denote the new coordinates in this space. Let me denote the new coordinates in this space as t. So we have t11 all the way to tk minus 21, t1n, tk minus 2n. Okay. And we still have a delta function at the end, which you cannot see here, unfortunately. So, but I can write it down for you. And this delta function, you can immediately recognize what it does. It's a delta function that is telling you that really you're not integrating over this space, you're integrating over this space. So you have to impose that your t-plane now is orthogonal to a four-plane, which is made out of the z variables, okay? So the formula that you cannot see there is the following. Let me write this Rn here. Let me just put a d here to save time. Remember, the z is a four vector. That's why I have a delta function, a four-dimensional delta function. And I have this many delta functions in order to have to make sure that every row of this metric is orthogonal to the four rows of the z matrix. Remember, I now have k by 2 by k by 2 minors from the T matrix. Okay, this is a formula that was supposed to be there. Now, we have hope to make this thing well-defined because the distributional part is outside, is in this piece, the momentum-conserving delta function. You would say, no, wait a minute. You still have delta functions here. But here comes a proposal. The proposal is that you can now make everything complex. The spinors that we were complaining were real, now you can make them complex. You can make everything complex if what you do is the following. You just replace these delta functions, and you put them down here. And you treat them as poles. Okay. Now, I declare that this is a contour integral. In k minus 2, m minus 4, minus k minus 2 dimensions. Okay? How do I remember this? Well, because this is a dimension of the physical Grassmannian, right? The gk minus 2, m minus 4. Now, this is a contour integral. This is a holomorphic measure. Now I have a meromorphic form that I can integrate on a contour. Now, in physics, we are very used to one-dimensional contour integrals. But now, when we were faced with this, we were faced with integrals with a contour, trying to define a contour integral in many dimensions. And of course, we had to go and learn about that. So Let me remind you the definition. So if you want to define a residue in many complex dimensions, all you have to do is to give a holomorphic map from CM to CM. Now, M, in this case, will be the dimension of the Grassmannian here. And then one defines a functional called the local residue that depends on the point P, which is a zero of the map that is assumed to be isolated. And then one gets a number if one plugs a function H that is holomorphic at P, and the number you get is by performing an integral over a Tn, an M torus, okay? This M torus is defined essentially by the faces of each of the components of the maps if you restrict the modulus to be some positive numbers, epsilon I. And the orientation is given by this, okay? Some trivial consequences of this definition is that the residue is anti-symmetric in the location of the components of the map. In other words, if you have this F and you flip the ordering of the components of the map, you get the same residue up to a sign. Now, something that was very nice for us, which we didn't know, was that, well, in one dimension, you have one residue theorem. But in several complex dimensions, you have something that is called the global residue theorem that states that the sum over all the local residues is zero. And if you have many, many functions here, many more than M, you can make many maps, and you can produce, that is a machinery to produce many residue theorems. So in several complex dimensions, you can have many residue theorems. And we were hoping that those residue theorems would come in handy. Very good. So, just to summarize a little bit, this is a proposal. The proposal is that this object multiply by this object knows about the physics, all the physics you need to compute the physical scattering amplitude nk. Okay? And more precisely, it's all the residues of this object, okay? Now we have to define this. I can tell you what the contour is. The contour is any t. Let me give a name to this. Let me call it M. Any Tm, any M torus, where I can define a residue of this object. Okay? Well, this will lead us now to try and understand the zeros of this denominator. Now, when you have zeros, when you have certain Plucker coordinates that are zero, you are restricting them to be zero, then you're talking about hypersurfaces in the Grassmannian, and that leads to a very interesting structure appearing in physics about the intersection of these hypersurfaces in the Grassmannian, okay, which is still work in progress. But let me try to show you how non-trivial this is, that is actually working, okay? So in order to do that, let's go back to physics for a moment, and let me tell you what is known up to now. It's known that if you take the case when k is equal to 3, you have 3 negative helicity gluons scattering and producing m minus k, m minus 3 positive helicity gluons. It has been shown that the residues of this object can be used to reproduce all the pieces in the scattering amplitude as well as for k equals 4. An example is the following. Let me take the case of 6 particles, 3 with positive helicity and 3 of negative helicity. It has been known for 5 years now that such an amplitude can be written as the sum of 2 terms or the sum of 3 terms. I've written for you the first expression with 2 terms, okay? Now it's much more interesting than the structure that I showed you for the Park-Taylor amplitude. It has more structure in it. In fact, now it depends on the square brackets, not only on the angular brackets. And there are similar formulas for these other ones. Now, something that a physicist will immediately complain about this formula is that there are some poles in this formula that are not physical. Things like these are unphysical poles. We should not be there in the scattering metrics. This comes from unitarity, There are many ways of knowing that such poles should not be there. But know that this pole is shared by the two terms. And if you sit for a day and do two-dimensional algebra, because you're now dealing with two vectors, the inner product of two vectors, so you sit down for a day, and then you can show that the residue of those poles is actually zero. So those poles are spurious. That's great, because they are unphysical. Know that the other poles don't appear in both terms at the same time, and therefore they cannot possibly go away. And those are physical poles, and these are spurious poles. Now, when you write down these three terms here, you will find similar formulas where the spurious poles that you find don't coincide with these spurious poles. So another way of showing that these unphysical poles are actually spurious, that are not there, is showing the equality of these two expressions. But showing that two terms are equal to three terms is actually much, much harder than showing that the spurious pole cancels in the first two terms. So here you might have to work for a week in order to show that these two things are actually equal to each other, okay? And that's what people were doing 5 years ago. Now, let me tell you what these five objects are. Take your formula. In the case of n equal to 6 and r equals to 3, work in the patch where t1 is equal to 1, and therefore it reduces to the following. Okay, this is your formula. Now, it's a contour integral in five dimensions. But I would like to use all these poles to carry out four of the integrations. There are four poles here, so I can carry out four of the integrations. After I do that, I'm left with an integral in a single complex dimension, okay, where each of these t's have now become linear functions of my single complex variable, where these a's and b's are now functions of the brackets that are supposed to make up my scattering amplitude. Well, what is supposed to be the contour that gives us the physical scattering amplitude? Well, the first thing that you see there is that you have precisely five poles in the complex plane. So if we call this a complex plane tau, we get precisely five poles associated to the points where t2 through t6 vanish. So let me say that this is t1. T2, T3, T4, and T5, where they vanish. Now we can compute five residues, okay, for this object. Just compute the five residues. And the surprise is that when you compute the five residues, you precisely find that A coincides with T2 and B coincides with T4. Therefore, if we choose this contour of integration, we reproduce a scattering amplitude. Now, how about C, D, and E? Well, you carry out the computation, and you find that C, D, and E are precisely the residues of this object here, here, and here. Now, you see that the equality of the two terms is absolutely trivial. It's just a consequence of a residue theorem. So we would like to see, we would like to say that the cancellation of spurious poles or of unphysical poles is actually a consequence of residue theorems. I've given here only the simplest of the examples, But when you go to more particles and increase k, proving that formulas are free of physical singularities is actually something that can only be done by computers, or could only be done by computers. Now, all those formulas have been shown to be consequences of residue theorems. Now, whenever you have a new formulation, you might expect to see new things happening in your theory. Well, given the new formulation, we could ask, are there any things that we can see that were not manifest before? And the answer is yes. We can see a new symmetry that was not there in the standard formulation of the scattering amplitudes that is very, very manifest here. And the way to do it is that we have to make a small improvement in the formula. And here we have to introduce four super coordinates. These are just four Grassmann variables. Okay, so we are introducing supersymmetry, precisely four of them. And we have to promote the vector z to be a superobject. Let me remind you that this was the vector z for the particle I. We promote it to be a super vector now, which is just the old one, together with four Grassmann components here. And we promote our r to be a superobject again, where I would like to think about the fermionic, about the bosonic delta functions as being poles, again, as I did here. But I didn't want to separate them, because putting them together in a delta function makes manifest that this object has a symmetry, which is superconformal, the superconformal symmetry, which is basically a rotation by the, in, is a rotation or an, by the action of the group SL4/4. That means that this object is manifestly invariant under superconformal invariants, superconformal transformations, okay? Regardless of the contour, it's just a statement that this delta function appears here, and the fermionic components and the bosonic components come together. But that's not the new symmetry. We all knew that this theory had to have this symmetry. In physics, we knew that. Now, the new symmetry is actually a Yang-Yang. So this is the superconformal symmetry I was talking about. This is just the SL4/4 transformation that you can perform on the object. Given the delta function, it's clear that any residue computed from RnK will be annihilated by this operator. But now the new thing is that you can define what are called level one operators. Okay? And precisely the cyclic structure of the denominators allows you to prove that for any closed contour, in particular, for any contour that defines a residue in RnK, the residues are also annihilated by these level one operators. Now, if you commute the level one operators with the level zero and level ones with level ones, you can start producing an infinite number of operators, and they generate what is called a Yang-Yang. And this, therefore, the residues of this object are Yang-Yang invariants. Okay? This Yang-Yang structure is completely hidden. It's very, very hard to see in any other formulation of the scattering amplitude. Okay. So let me almost end this talk by making two conjectures, or by describing the two conjectures that people are working on nowadays. The first one is that the set of all local residues of RnK, of this object I've defined here, in its supersymmetric form, not just in the form that is written here, but in the super form where we have the four fermionic delta functions in the numerator. Note that this is just one component of that object, the one that I've written there. Provide all invariants of the Yang-Yang and their relations in the form of global residue theorems, okay? And the other conjecture is a more physical conjecture. The first one is a conjecture made in math, so to speak. The second conjecture is a physical conjecture, and is that the set of residues of RnK and the set of leading singularities of scattering amplitudes, at least in n equals 4 supergermanians, are the same. What are these leading singularities? What do I mean by that? Well, what I mean by that is that you can take these scattering amplitudes, and there is a way of defining a product of scattering amplitudes to produce bigger objects that control the scattering amplitude as well. So if you have a scattering amplitude of 6 particles, you can produce objects that are made by jamming together three particle and four particle interaction amplitudes against each other. And the fascinating fact is that jamming together these residues that are defined in different Grassmannians. So you can take different Grassmannians, you can compute residues there, you can jam them together in a particular way, and what seems to be happening is that when you do that, the end result is a residue in a bigger Grassmannian. That is quite non-trivial, and it has been shown in certain infinite classes of cases, but it hasn't been shown completely. And there is a further conjecture now in physics which says that the full scattering matrix in n equals 4 supergermials can be determined if you know all these objects. And if this conjecture, if the first conjecture is, the second conjecture is true, it would mean that if you know all the residues of this object, you will know all the elements you need in order to build the S matrix of n equals 4 supergermials. So the conclusion, as I said, we don't have any theorems, not yet, but the conclusion is that we have only started to understand the properties of this object and its connection to physics, and I hope we will get the help of mathematicians in order to understand this object further and make progress in both directions, in math and physics. Thank you. Excellent. That's a very good question. So for k equals 3, k equals 4, we know precisely which residues you have to take. Now, at different levels in perturbation theory, some particular residues appear, and some others appear later on. Now, the conjecture is that the number of residues that you can compute is finite, but that then this finite set of residues is all you need for all orders in perturbation theory. So that's Dave Skinner, the next speaker, will probably talk about a different way of thinking about the structure of the residues that you have to take in order to get a given scattering amplitude. Right? So your question is basically, how could you know in advance that this was the contour you wanted to choose and not something else? Yes. So now we have a better understanding of what the condition is. In fact, in this case, it's so simple that all you have to impose is that the answer is going to have a cyclic symmetry. Just cyclicity tells you that that this is the only contour that you can pick. No, I don't think anybody has tried that. Something that has been tried a little bit is to see whether you can rewrite this as correlation functions in Landau-Gisbert theory, say. But no, I don't think that. Once again, this is something that is only less than a year old. So not many things have been tried. No, so you see, each residue, each object is Young-Yang invariant. So Andy's question is very important. So if each block is Young-Yang invariant, what tells you which combination is a physical amplitude? It has to be something that is on top of the Young-Yang symmetry.